This week on the PhD cast, Emma releases figures showing that readership is massively made up for declines in circulation. How believable are the figures, and what do we make of them in light of the declines in circulation? Also, how much is a print audience actually worth? New methodology from Roy Morgan claims to tell us exactly what a Marie Claire reader is worth compared to one of National Geographic. And finally this week, BuzzFeed expands thanks to a $50 million investment. Just how big can BuzzFeed get? That and more on the PhD cast from PhD Australia. Hey, I'm Chris Stevenson. Joining me on the PhD cast this week, I've got regulars Lauren Oldham.
Hello.
Emma Glazer.
Hello.
Stuart Gurney.
G'day.
And KZ Christian-Zavala.
Hello.
Also joining us this week is our head of trading, Lucy Formosa Morgan.
Hello.
And in a special guest appearance from PhD New York, it is the return of Nicola Davey.
Hi, folks.
How are you doing, Nicola?
I'm awesome, totally awesome.
How long since you departed the podcast regularity?
It's been 9 months, long enough to have a baby.
Anything you want to tell us?
I haven't had one, but Nelly almost is.
No, well, regular listeners will know that Nelly, one of our BDs, is almost ready to pop, so well done. So how is New York? How's everything going?
Yeah, it's cool. I love it. It's awesome. I miss you guys, though. And there's no PhD cast, so...
Not yet.
Well, those listeners from PhD New York, hello, by the way, our New York listeners. That's every reason to get one up and running. So the conversation can truly be global. That's more than enough of that. Let's get going. Emma, this week, has announced new figures showing significant increases in the number of readers per copy. For all but four of the titles that it audits. They include The Age rising from 5.22 readers per copy to 6.23. Zoo Weekly, that's of course part of Bauer, 9.44 to 15.24 readers for every copy. The Northern Territory News has gone from 64,000 to 70,000, and the Daily Telegraph also gaining readers despite drop in circulation. All those titles covering Fairfax, Bauer and News Corp increases in readership despite declines in circulation. Zoo Weekly, 15.24 people reading each edition. Discuss.
Unlikely. Kind of very answer. So that's mental. So 15 people.
On average.
So some
copies are getting read by what?
35. How? The big question is obviously around methodology, and I think that's the big thing. Like, we don't know. I'm not clear as to how the methodology has led to such discrepancies in data. And that for me, and I think the industry is of the same opinion. There are obviously anomalies that happen in data, but the discrepancies are so inconsistent that I think it does throw up kind of big questions around Emma.
On that, not our Emma, Big Emma, or other Emma rather. You're not little Emma. So there has been a statement released from Ipsos. Ipsos run the survey on behalf of Emma. There has been a statement from Adam Hodgson, which he said, in terms of readers per copy, Australian numbers are well in line with international norms. Our reader per copy averages 3.4 across major national and metro Monday Sun newspapers. The Netherlands, it turns out, it's 4. France, it's 4.5. And Italy, it's 8 average. So... readership is higher than circulation, but to what extent do we think these numbers are viable, and to what extent do we think that they can actually account for a decline in circulation?
I think that they look funny, so whether or not you can say that they're right or wrong, I think needs more discussion in terms of methodology, as Stu pointed out earlier. But they are definitely suspect, and especially given that it's funded by the industry, it seems like most of media buyers would be right in being suspect about what exactly is going on, because I can't imagine one of the arguments was that in economic hardship, people are just sharing their print magazines and newspapers more, but I just don't
amongst whole streets, it would seem. Whole communities gathering together around
to
Zoo Weekly.
To read one magazine just doesn't seem like a likely habit.
So it's fair to say there's some skepticism out there amongst the media trading community. Lucy, are you one of them?
I am, not surprisingly. So we've always worked to around a three times from a readership perspective, but some of these numbers are just so different.
Just in terms of historical context, where does three come from? Because that's what Roy Morgan claimed. Roy Morgan worked on three. The average is 4.2 from Emma, so there's clearly discrepancy there. Where does the three come from?
It's historically from Roy Morgan, obviously, from their research over the years across every country. So, that's where everyone's been indoctrined from. But I think if you're going to try and change the methodology and change these sort of numbers so drastically, you've got to come to market with, more substance to it rather than just, some big claims.
And what do you think the benefit for potentially, massaging numbers to make them look better? Because it's quite widely accepted, and it's kind of in these articles as well, that these publications are all massively losing a lot of money. So what do you think the implication could be for they're still losing money, but they're claiming to have this bigger, better reach? Do you think they're going to try and up their, costs to advertise?
Emma is funded by the publishers, so you'd expect them to come out with positive results. They're not going to, you wouldn't expect, want to pay for something if it doesn't show them in a good light.
Yeah. Because for people who aren't aware, Emma was an independent, Emma was a separate measurement system for the print industry to Roy Morgan, set up by the print industry, and it hasn't been cheap. Several $1 million have been invested, into setting this up. Right, so there's are they expecting an ROI on this?
Well, evidently, that's clear, isn't it? So they can. I mean, the negotiation points for press trading, circulation, and readership. If they can't handle circulation, but they can try and kind of, moisten, which is the complete wrong word. Massage. massage the numbers around readership, then that potentially gives them a better trading position. It's whether we believe them as a media buying community that actually is the case.
As a digital person, can someone clarify what we actually buy on? Do we buy on readership or do we buy on circulation?
We buy on both.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's why it is such an important factor.
We've had the conversation a few times before, and we've done some work, and we've done some kind of thought leadership points of view around magazines or print brands and their role in the media kind of landscape, and actually them not seeing themselves just purely as print titles or print brands anymore. And it feels like
masthead.
Exactly, and think about them as content providers. So my content provider is Marie Claire, and actually the format by which I access that content is actually redundant. And I think actually by having things like Emma, it's keeping them in the old school, because continuing the conversation about old school metric, as opposed to looking at, okay, well, I want to see if, maybe you have increased audiences to your content, but that doesn't have to necessarily come through to print. So it kind of frustrates me why, as an industry, we're still trying to protect this print aspect, because it's about the content that these
But when you've got two sales houses selling Bauer products, for example, so Bauer selling the print and then MI9 selling their digital offering, or majority of it, you've got to have two different methodologies or numbers to be able to sell the content.
And what other possible word could you describe that situation other than insanity?
Inconsistent.
It is disjointed.
Okay.
There we are.
There we go. But there's certainly a case to be made that what we are seeing are publishers fighting for the biggest share of an ever diminishing pot. And as we'll come to see, the real bad guy is over the hill and coming quick in the form of other digital publishers, right?
Yeah.
Digital-only publishers.
Yeah, and I think it's exactly to Nicola's point, like the whole retrospectiveness of kind of focusing on old metrics and old ways of trading that are hindering the process. Like, it would be much more beneficial if Emma could develop a cost per engagement metric or cost per, I don't know, something that's slightly more equity based that demonstrates the actual relevance of those brands to advertisers would be a much better way to.
But I think they have to justify their print numbers first, because at the moment, you know, based on this article, so many comments, our comments, a lot of people are questioning the methodology. So if they're going to then spend a heap of cash incorporating digital as well, you know, you question whether anyone would take it up.
Well, they should just stay away from readership, is what I'm saying. Yeah. Like, develop a whole new metric that's nothing to do with the old school way of thinking about press buying.
Speaking of which, also this week, Roy Morgan have announced they can tell us how much an audience is worth based on what they read. This is news that they can tell us how much the average Marie Claire reader is worth to advertisers. It turns out it's not as much as someone who reads Women's Weekly or National Geographic. They've come up with a new media buying metric that tells advertisers the audience dollar value by overlaying audience and readership figures with online buying habits. This is all reported in this week's Ad News. They say that in a first for Australia, the measurement works out the audience values across newspapers, magazines, TV shows and channels, radio stations and websites. And that's based on 50,000 people that Roy Morgan surveys each year. If a survey participant says they read Marie Claire, the figure they gave for how much they spend online is included in Marie Claire's audience dollar value. Someone help me understand what's going on here.
I'm not clear of the purpose. So why did they do that? Why did they only take into consideration online expenditures, for instance, as opposed to, I don't know, calculating a personal value based on average household income to which they anyway actually have access to?
Or breaking it down to spend in terms of household stuff, or spend in terms of clothing, holiday, like, wouldn't that be more valuable if it's from a planning perspective?
No, I think because, so we've talked about Ehrenberg Bass quite a lot, lots and lots actually on this podcast, and actually you shouldn't focus on specific propensities of groups. So if you've got a product, you should be talking to all users of that category, whether they have loads of money or not is actually indiscriminate. It's whether they want to buy your product that's important. So I fail to see how this would make me want to put any of those titles onto a schedule.
Well, Michelle Levine, who's the CEO of Roy Morgan Research, would probably think otherwise. She said in a statement, This research shows Australians spend an average of $750 million a week online. We are now using our audience expenditure data to quantify the dollar value of magazines and other media in terms of their reach into the lucrative online market. She went on to say, in a media landscape where the debate seems to be traditional media versus digital media, this new perspective shows the power of traditional media to reach into and influence online purchasing and decision making.
Wow. I don't know which media landscape is where the debate is still about traditional media versus digital media as opposed to media.
Well, I think there are some less advanced agencies, but I'd argue that still having that debate. I think it's really interesting that we're considering this article in context of the Emma article, because that feels very
it's not a coincidence.
Very much a desperate attempt by Roy Morgan. Well, desperate, maybe. A bit hard.
A timely attempt
at Roy Morgan to try and kind of prove its value in the press arena still. And try and get people on board with its survey. I think they've missed the mark in terms of the value of that value, because it doesn't actually influence advertisers very much.
I certainly don't think it's a currency.
No, I think it's a bit of a wild step to say it's going to be useful for any kind of media planning.
And we would certainly never plan or make channel sessions on that basis.
Yeah, I mean, because there's a massive assumption to go, because of Mary, what is it, Women's Weekly reader is on average, got more money, she's going to spend more money on your product.
And someone who dropped money on National Geographic is probably, of course, correspondingly more likely to spend money on it. Doesn't mean they're doing it because they read National Geographic.
That's the really frustrating thing. It's like, you know, you profile all of the mag readers by socioeconomic group or household income or that kind of thing. It's just it's just another layer of pointless information because it's got no, it goes back to Stu's point, it still doesn't give any greater standing that that title is going to influence the decision maker, the decision, you know, to purchase your product or not. That's it's those two influence and spend are still worlds apart. They're on completely the other end of the spectrum. So it's just pointless.
And as a planning community, when we do identify print mastheads or brands in the print sphere as relevant or appropriate for a campaign or a project, how should you and how do you go about making those kind of choices between which of those brands you go for and which mastheads you're going to invest behind on behalf of our clients?
Well, we obviously plan based on channels and how creativity, so the idea and the way that we've worked with that publisher, but then also the weighted CPM, so how much is that going to cost in relation to the propensity of that audience reading your magazine. So that for us is how we would title select, I guess. And also we've got tools specifically that allow us to still evaluate different components of that press schedule, be that readership, be that circulation, all the different variables that will help us kind of decide which channel we should use.
Cool. Well, for more on that story, it's on the pages of Ad News this week. And for more on the story about Emma and their figures, that was on Umbrella, but has also been very widely reported this week. So as print publishers battle it out with various different media metrics, over the hill comes BuzzFeed and a $50 million investment, which Adweek describes as nothing short of seeing them able to take over the world. In a statement from BuzzFeed, today we think the time is perfect to grow our company, build our brand, and greatly increase the content we're producing so we can be the number one digital media brand. This investment will allow us to double down on our company's mission by creating a new organization and expanding rapidly. That is from BuzzFeed CEO Jonah Peretti. The impact will be significant. A whole editorial division, now grouped into three categories, news, buzz, and life. All native ads fall under BuzzFeed creative category. All videos under BuzzFeed motion pictures. Oh, yes, they've even got a motion pictures arm. They'll soon encompass mid feature-length projects in addition to viral clips and GIFs. It's not just an increase in product, they're bolstering their global reach with new offices in India, Germany, Mexico, and Japan sometime this year. $50 million, it's not a small amount to drop into to a company. This is significant, right?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, they've obviously going to be investing some of that money actually in the product and in the pillars that will fundamentally make up BuzzFeed. But what I'm interested in more about is the geographic span that this BuzzFeed brand is now going to have a footprint in, because what makes BuzzFeed work is the cultural relevance and the contextual relevance with people. And sure, the content spreads. They've got lots of data that shows how when they've done things specific to, I don't know, so let's just say Welsh people, because I'm from Wales, the exponential reach that bit of content gets from, you know, how me and all my Welshy friends spread that because we identify with it. It means that non-Welshies, the number of non-Welshies see it like much greater. So I think
For example, 14 ways to spot a drunk Welsh girl at a party.
Yes.
And stories like that.
Exactly. And so what I think it's brilliant. And I don't see it being going, oh, how many more like lolcats do we need? I think that what they're doing is it's the geography and the ability to be a lot more contextual and socially relevant in more places, which I see where the growth will come from. And brilliant, bring it on.
I think
car in the car park agrees.
In this market, the infrastructure just isn't there, and so it's hard to do interesting things with BuzzFeed currently. I think a lot of that money should be invested into the infrastructure. So I think we have to wait quite a lot for America to wake up before we can do stuff.
And you say infrastructure in terms of people on the ground in Australia, we can talk to, work with, get content made.
There's Australian content, but like getting proper Australian integration, and we talked about native advertising, all that stuff. proper ideas that are centred around the clients and their needs specifically in this market.
And they talk a lot to us. I've been talking a lot to them as a global team about that, and I know that that's where, you know, they constantly talk about how much they grow in Australia, because Australian numbers for them are shooting, rising up, but clearly for us guys actually doing anything on behalf of our brands in this market is really challenging, because they haven't got the resource to be able to almost to meet their numbers, really. So for advertisers to be capitalising on the fact that there's this great demand for BuzzFeed type content.
And what kind of threat do we think the rise of BuzzFeed and brands like it, HuffPost, others like it, is it a coincidence that print is being so aggressive in its metrics and its assertions in this space? How big a threat are these growing digital publishers to those traditional models?
I think they're huge. You know, everyone can get their content however they want it these days. There's so much option out there. But I think the online publishers, you know, certainly think differently and are operating differently to what the traditional print publishers are.
It's much more sort of instantaneous content. Not all of this is about news. Like, I would still go to websites and online environments to find, you know, sort of fashion articles or celebrity stuff or that kind of snackable content, which is all essentially for free as well at the same time, rather than everything you pick up now in a magazine is, or even a newspaper is old once you pick it up. So I think, massively from our content consumption habits and what we now expect, how instant we expect to see things and access whatever we want when we want, is really what I think.
I think that's an important point, because my big watch out would be with the growth comes dilution of product, and they are awesome at random crap on the internet, right? And if I've got an extra 5 minutes in my day, I've got to look at some
ads. Put that quote in their marketing team.
Never, I'm always very, very busy. If I want to look at a small piece of content or look at some random cats that I want to put on Nicola's wall, typically, that would be the place I choose. So I'm very clear about what the product offer is. It's not a news site. I don't go there for any information in a real sense.
It's more gossipy.
And I think that's great, because I have a really clear engram of what that's offering me. And I think the danger is growing rapidly and trying to grow your offering to the point where it becomes difficult to understand for consumers to actually get.
And that's where I think that the aspiration to be the biggest media brand, it's almost like to suit which purpose, because I wouldn't go to them over the likes of the HuffPost or, you know, something like that. If I want more analysis or, you know, in-depth news type stuff. It's fine them kind of having this big hairy goal if we want to be the number one media brand, but there's always going to be a big space kind of opportunity for lots of big digital media brands, actually.
So they need to target more than...
This is why I'm also nervous about the BuzzFeed motion pictures arm, for instance. Like, what would be the content? Because right now, exactly what we are talking about, this little bite-sized content that's like absolutely almost like when you just in a sort of brain dump and you just want to forward something and have 2 minutes to actually consume it, that's awesome. But they're going to produce the next Hangover movie so these are the type of content I'm actually associating BuzzFeed with, and I'm just nervous how much need or demand there is actually for this type of content.
Like everything to everybody.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Rather than excelling in one area.
Mm. With rapid growth comes great responsibility.
Words of wisdom.
More lolcats.
I'm just thinking, sorry. And actually, it was interesting because there was a keynote given to Umbrella this year by Keith Hernandez, and they're quite clear on what they think. I mean, they said four things in that presentation. They said that social is the new starting point, and they have a consistent, always-on story. Nobody wants to be friends with brands, so tell a great story, get out of the way. They made the point that video can be social, and they made the point about being very human. So they were here a few months ago, making a lot of inroads and giving brands advice in terms of how to get the most out of this platform. What is our take, just to finish up, on what brands can get out of this platform? What do we think is the relevance of BuzzFeed brands, and what advice are we giving to our clients or to brands per se, in terms of how to use this and its relevance and what it's for?
So my opinion would be to be part of the cultural conversation. I think to all those points, it's great at tapping into cultural nuances, the geography and relevance of the time. So for brands that want to do that and have a real-time opinion, it's a great platform.
And it's, I've actually got a global prop with one of our PhD global clients at the moment to do an annual content program with BuzzFeed. And what's brilliant about the prop is the fact that it doesn't talk about product, it talks about the purpose of the brand. And because of the, you know, the content that BuzzFeed is used to kind of spaffing out there in lots of volumes, it's a great opportunity for brands that are clear on what their purpose is to tap into this, to tap into the human nature of that, and to be part of a completely organic conversation that people want to have. We know that people want to have these conversations.
But, you know, from a cash injection perspective, you do question that the internet landscape has changed so much over the last few years. You know, how will it change in another couple of years? Will BuzzFeed still be, where people go for that, or there'll be something else by then?
Yeah,
that people
the fickle world of the internet.
Yeah.
Pick and choose.
Fickle it is, and as are we. That's all we've got time for. We've got a
fickle way.
Nicola!
I loved it!
Thanks for joining us, Nicola.
Thanks. Can it be like The Expendables and we just like keep bringing more people back? I just have a load of like ex-PhD Australia people.
Yeah, we can totally do that. Next week joining us, Carly Boyle and Antonio Maderas.
Yeah. We're also joining the PhD cars in New York.
Yeah. We're going to
Stay tuned here for PhD Cast New York. In the meantime, thanks for listening, thanks for downloading. Enjoy your media week, and we'll be back next week. Thanks to everyone for taking part. That was the PhD Cast from PhD Australia. We'll be back next week.
To get more from PhD Australia, you can like us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or find us on Google+ at PhD Australia. Oh, I love a hoo-ha, I do.
Very good, Nick. Well done. Thanks, everyone.
We need a theme song.